This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. Neil Conan is on vacation. As we say so long to 2006, we're taking one last look back at the year in media and culture. Sites like YouTube changed the way many people get and share their information. Time magazine even named you their person of the year for 2006. But while amateur video makers became the latest online trendsetters, several more established figures had to watch their minor gaffes grow into major incidents online. As YouTube popularized some unlikely personalities, print media saw rapid declines in 2006, and news networks handled some of the year's biggest stories in some mightily unorthodox ways. Today we'll talk with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik about the highs and lows in media this year. We'll hear from a YouTube expert on the growing influence of that site, and New York Times film critic A.O. Scott joins us on The Year in Film. Later in the hour, we'll talk about some homemade cures for that New Year's hangover. If you have a favorite remedy, mail it to us. Email it to us. Don't use mail. That'll take too long. Email it to us at talk@npr.org. But first, the year in media. We want to hear from you about that as well. What media moments top your list for 2006? Has online video changed what you watch? And who are you watching? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address, again, is talk@npr.org. And sitting across from me in Studio 3A is David Folkenflik. He covers the world of media for NPR's Arts Desk. Welcome very much. Hey. Welcome very much to come to the program, or some words like that.
Hey, Happy New Year. We're all dealing with the vestiges of last night.
Please. Okay, so I just talked about the big media stories this year, but I guess in one sense, one of the big media stories is the media itself as it's going through this kind of upheaving, especially in the print world.
So. Sure. Well, as we go from the old year to the new, let's talk a little bit about the old-fashioned so-called mainstream media a little bit. And let's talk about newspapers. This was a year where a lot of the pressures building on newspapers really seemed to pop. There was a significant, you could say sort of in some ways, lack of faith and loss of faith in how the old model was working. You saw the second largest newspaper chain in the country go out of existence. Forced to sell itself off, the Knight Ridder newspaper chain, earlier this year.
But wait a minute, what was the old model? What does that mean? Just the newspapers with 40 pages and lots of advertising? What was killing it?
The newspapers, I mean, we're killing it, but
we broadcast media, or we Americans.
The country. We're changing our habits. You know, David Carr, the New York Times this morning had sort of a eulogy for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which was just sold by the McClatchy Company. One of the fascinating things is this is a newspaper making close to 20% profit margins, the largest newspaper in the McClatchy chain. McClatchy, by the way, had bought the Knight Ridder newspaper company earlier this year and then sold off its less profitable papers. It decided, you know what? It's in a sort of older, less growth-oriented part of the country. It's not getting that 25 to 30% profit margin they so want. And they wanted to be done with it. Our reading habits are changed. The question of where we look to for information has changed. People are not simply going to broadcast media. If you look at television news on the networks, if you look at cable news, they're actually all kind of losing and constricting in their share of the market. We're going everywhere else, and we're becoming sort of our own media sifters. But it used to be that the newspapers defined the news agenda, that you couldn't really function as an informed citizen, as a part of civic society, if you didn't know what was happening in your immediate city or region, and you didn't know what was happening in the world at large. And even smaller newspapers provided that for people. They sat down. It was common ground to talk about. That's happening less and less and less. And you're seeing also the financial model being winnowed away because, to be honest, it's the classified ads that really drove a lot of the profits of newspapers. And when you have less expensive online and you have free online things like Craigslist, it's really eroding the newspaper's financial base.
So are there going to be major cities in America in the coming year that aren't going to have a daily newspaper?
I don't think that's the case. I think it'll always be there. But like the networks themselves, they're not commanding the monopoly of attention in the same way that they once did. I think you'll still see newspapers. If you look at a city like Philadelphia, where the Inquirer, once one of the greatest newspapers in the country, has been forced over the years to constrict and constrict and constrict. It's still there, but they're going to have to cut back yet again quite severely in order to make even the much more modest profit margins that are demanded by their new owners.
How about the war in Iraq? Was there? It feels to me like there was a shift in the way the war is being covered and the attitudes about how the war is going in the media. Do you sense that? Do others sense that?
Well, one way to gauge that was a little bit ago, within the last month or so, several news organizations decided to, most of them quietly, NBC quite noisily, decided to shift its terminology for the kind of Shiite and Sunni clashes going on in Iraq from calling that sectarian strife to calling it civil war. Mm-hmm. And the reason that that's an interesting semantic shift, if you will, is that Americans on the whole don't like getting involved in other people's civil wars. Even if they're reason to believe that you have sympathies on one side or another, it's a general rule of thumb, you just don't do that. By shifting to that terminology, which the Bush administration has resisted every inch of the way, it sort of said, we are not simply going to mirror the language and the rhetoric coming out of the administration. That is sort of in miniature a way of depicting that kind of shift. Mm-hmm. I think you saw some very tough reporting on under excruciatingly difficult circumstances in Iraq. You've got to remember, it's very dangerous. This was the most dangerous year on record for journalists in the world. And Iraq, that war has become the most dangerous war in terms of recorded how deadly it's been for journalists to cover. And so they're often very limited where they can go and what they can cover. But they have reported a lot of the real difficulty that the U.S. and its Iraqi allies have had in maintaining any kind of social cohesion over there.
Hmm. Another sort of defining moment for the media this year was the thing that didn't happen, and that was the coverage of the O.J. Simpson interview that Fox News suddenly decided at what it must have been recorded already, but it must have been the last moment not to air.
Well,
or was it recorded already? Do we know that? Is there a tape someplace?
I believe it was taped.
Yeah.
And I believe it was concluded and wrapped up and prepared. It's my recollection. But in a twisted way, I kind of love this story. It illustrates a couple of different things going on. As you were saying, this is where O.J. Simpson had entered an agreement with HarperCollins Books and the publisher, particularly their subdivision called Regan Books, led by Judith Regan, then the publisher, to write a book explaining how he would have killed his ex-wife and her friend, had he done so, which he does not acknowledge doing. This seemed like extraordinarily exploitative as a book. Money was funded to accounts that seemingly would have been controlled by O.J. Simpson, although it wouldn't go directly to him as a way of avoiding his civil liability on lawsuits filed against him by the survivors of those two people. In addition, Fox Television Network, not Fox News, but the Fox Television Network was going to broadcast 2 hours of that interview, and he was going to be grilled about that very topic by Judith Regan, a contributor to the sister Fox News channel. This is interesting in two ways. One is it shows corporate synergy at its, in some ways, most cynical, because HarperCollins Books and Fox Television are both owned by the News Corporation of Rupert Murdoch. And it also shows the boundaries of taste, which Fox is often in the business of testing. And there was an incredible backlash. And as a business decision, a number of Fox affiliates all pulled away and dropped out and said, we're not going to participate. And then you saw, as a portrayed as a moral decision, Murdoch himself intervened to say, we're not going to publish this book. We're not going to air this interview. And we're not going to give any more money than we're contractually obligated to Mr. Simpson and his family. So it showed both the corporate integration of profits and also the boundaries of good taste.
You know, I was asking about whether it existed or not, because what's been happening, I noticed, is that when things exist, they have a way of showing up on the internet. And I guess that brings us to the topic of YouTube. YouTube was founded in 2005, and I don't know, it sold for, what, $1 billion this year, something like that, when it was bought by Google in October. YouTube co-founders Chad Hurley and Steve Chen announced the purchase in an online video they released on the site.
This is Chad and Steve. We're the co-founders of the site, and we just want to say thank you. Today we have some exciting news for you. We've been acquired by Google.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks to every one of you guys that have been contributing to YouTube, the community. We wouldn't be anywhere close to where we are without the help of this community.
Joining us now to talk about YouTube's influence in the media and culture is Wired.com reporter Lore Schoberg. He's the author of the article, The Year in Online Media, for Wired.com, and joins us today from the studios of member station KQED. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, how did it happen? I mean, what did they do right? How did they do this, these two guys?
I think one thing they did right was to create not just a place to put up videos, but put up to make a place to put up videos to make them as accessible as possible. You can embed most videos on YouTube in your own homepage. You can visit them freely. There's no lines to download them. And then on top of that, they created a community and encouraged people to interact in this community, creating ways for people to respond to each other and sort of create a conversation through video as well as through posting to message boards.
So, but how did it go from an internet startup to the cover of Time magazine? I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, it is huge. And in part, it was due to the people who contributed to it. It's not like a Microsoft where you get the best and the brightest. You put them in a room and you make them come up with something. This was opening it up to everybody who is out there. Like Time magazine says, you are the person of the year. And it gets people ranging from Peter, the geriatric 1927, the guy telling his stories about World War II, to people making their own videos, to people experimenting with Mentos and Diet Coke.
And I guess we'd tell them to just briefly describe that one, because that's an amazing video to see.
That last one, the Mentos and Diet Coke? Yeah, it is amazing. One thing about it is that it actually, the fad, as it were, started in late 2005, where someone just posted a clip of some local news show where demonstrating that if you drop a few Mentos into a 2-liter bottle of Diet Coke, it immediately spurts out in this huge geyser of carbonation. And if this had been 10 years ago, it probably would have stopped there. But with YouTube, it created sort of a competition as people came up with more elaborate and interesting ways to make Mentos and Diet Coke interact. My favorite, the video you're talking about, is one in which two guys have this table filled with 2-liter bottles of Diet Coke, and they have this elaborate choreography where they drop the Mentos into the Coke and have the geysers spurting up and swinging back and forth. It looks like a fountain out front of a public
building. I have to cut you off there just because we're taking a short break. We're taking a last look back at the year in culture. We'll be joined by New York Times reporter A.O. Scott for more of your favorite moments. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're rounding up in the year in culture this hour, and my guests are David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent, as well as Wired.com reporter Laura Schoberg. In a moment, we'll talk about the year in movies with A.O. Scott. What were your favorite flicks from the year? What made you forget all about the popcorn? Give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And we've been talking about some of the media events this year, and we'd like to hear from you. So let's first go to Rachel in Anchorage, Alaska. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, fine, except we're in afternoon already. We're way ahead of you.
Sorry.
That's all right.
I just wanted to comment about how we get our news. And as an example, this whole Michael Richards thing that exploded because somebody had their cell phone videoing it.
Explain, what was that event? Tell us about that.
When Michael Richards lost his temper in the comedy club and started calling people names. And, you know, we never really, you know, people would have heard about it, but they would have only heard about it by mouth if somebody hadn't recorded it on their cell phone. And so we actually are now getting our news from each other in a real creepy kind of way.
Yeah, that's interesting. Laura Schoberg, how do you see that changing what appears on the web these days?
Well, I think that you can find lots of stories in which the government acts as Big Brother, as in 1984. I think that fewer people foresaw that we would kind of become each other's Big Brother, with all of us holding, many of us holding devices that can take photos or even movies. Suddenly the surveillance isn't just something that's coming down from on high. We're keeping an eye on each other as well. That applies to the Michael Richards video. It also applies to stuff that might seem more benign, like playing pranks on people or just catching them at an unwary moment. But each of us has the possibility, the moment we leave our house, to end up on someone else's YouTube video.
Right. David Folkenflik, you wanted to...
Well, it seems to me it's the caller's exactly right that we're seeing a time where people can act as their own reporters and their own sort of disseminators of information. And they can also serve as their own consumers in a different way. So it's both input and taking down. So, for example, you got this kind of in-demand news scenario where somebody is, as she says, taking the Michael Richards tirade from a comedy club. You can also have people circumvent the taste arbiters at the networks and the major newspapers and decide they're going to find the video of Saddam Hussein being executed, and they're going to see more than just the noose put on his head. They're going to watch the hanging because someone, apparently perhaps also using a cell phone, you know, recorded that as well. And they can take it down and get around, you know, the news editors, the judgment of establishment media. You see major news organizations also trying to incorporate that. You see, for example, our own initiative, NPR's Michelle Martin is doing this new initiative, a new program that they're testing out, and their beta version of it is actually being done through our website where listeners are being encouraged to give feedback as it's being developed. There's this weird sort of give-take incorporation of feedback sort of ahead of the fact, which is, in some ways, I think, a reaction to what Rachel's been describing.
Rachel, thanks for that call. Laura Schoberg, I want to come back to you. How do these things become popular? I mean, in other words, how do they become popular? I mean, somebody's got to find it to begin with, then somebody else has to find it, then enough people also have to find it. I mean, is this just an emergent property of a popular thing on the media on the internet?
Well, there are a lot of people who have their eyes on YouTube. There are people who are employees of YouTube who look for stuff to put on the front page. There are also people who just have an intense interest in it. There are subscription services. And then once something starts to become popular, it can just completely explode, in part because, as I said before, YouTube allows you to embed the videos on your own site, which provides a great incentive for people to do so and to not just say, go over here and look at this, but to say, here you are, click on this, look at it right now. So there's kind of this effect. It gets started with a few people, but then through the, as they say, viral dissemination of the web, it's everywhere all of a sudden.
Well, Laura Schoberg, thanks very much for joining us and giving us that insight to that part of this cultural world, which we're emerging from and racing into, I guess.
Thank you.
Laura Schoberg is a reporter for Wired.com. He joined us today from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco. It was a memorable year for professional filmmakers as well. Queens, from the 18th century to the 20th, vied for popularity with wartime dramas and the occasional journalist imposter. A.O. Scott is a film critic for the New York Times. He joins us now to talk about the 2006 cinematic highlights from his home in New York. Thanks for being with us today.
Very nice to be here.
So, what made your list of the top films in 2006?
Well, at the very top, really for the second time in 3 years, was a Clint Eastwood movie, Letters from Iwo Jima, the second of his two sort of paired movies on the Battle of Iwo Jima in World War II. The first one, Flags of Our Fathers, told the story from the point of view of the American Marines who raised the flag there. Letters from Iwo Jima is a Japanese language movie about the experiences of the Japanese soldiers, and a really remarkable war movie, just a very moving and also very thought-provoking film. And Clint Eastwood's career, you know, since he turned 70 has been just remarkable. I'd say since Mystic River, I think that's three movies of his in 4 years that have been in the top five of my top ten. So he's really quite a national treasure, I think.
Is his work making enough money? is he going to be shunned because he's not, you know, gobbling up box office like some of the others? Or is he well-established and raking in enough bucks to be satisfactory?
Well, we'll see. I mean, he had a hard time getting these made. He had to make these at two different studios through his own production company. He tends to be very thrifty. One of the reasons that he's able to get movies made, apart from his star power and the fact that his movies have done pretty well and have, you know, certainly won a lot of awards and honors, which matters in Hollywood, maybe not as much as box office, but does matter. You know, he tends to make these things under budget and is good at raising money. Flags of Our Fathers didn't do as well at the box office as many had hoped. Letters from Iwo Jima, you know, maybe a tough sell. It's a subtitled film. It's very somber. It's a movie that is in some ways sympathetic, you know, if not to the cause of America's enemy in World War II, certainly to the some of the men who were fighting for that cause. But I think he just goes on. I mean, he's a very wily player in Hollywood, and I think you know there are enough people in the studios who will want to do business with him. And I would say it has been a somewhat encouraging year, just in terms of the ambitious movies that have at least been allowed to come through the pipeline. They haven't always found the audiences that they might have, but there does seem at least to be some room. I mean, think about a movie like Babel or a movie like Children of Men, Alfonso Cuarón's sort of futuristic science fiction movie that Universal released on Christmas Day. These are very challenging movies by very smart, ambitious, talented filmmakers, and I think there is some grounds for guarded optimism that they were able to be made and to be seen.
David Folkenflik, who's here in the studio with me, I don't want to spring this on you, but maybe you know the answer. Films, are they running into any trouble, the movie industry, the way that the newspaper industry is, because of the advent of this internet availability of media, films, what have you, or are movies not being affected by that quite as much? And if you don't know, I apologize for springing
that on
you.
Well, I'm guessing Tony Scott knows a bit more about this than I do. My sense is that they've had a pretty decent run through DVDs as a way of sort of augmenting income. I mean, I've always amazed when films are described as having disappointing yield, and when you look at the total domestic international gross, right, cable rights, and DVDs, you're saying, golly, these films are making a lot of money, even the ones that are claimed and dismissed to be financial duds.
Yeah.
My understanding is that the DVD market share is starting to just kind of slow and plateau, and that there's concern about that. And again, maybe Tony has more insight, but my sense is that on the whole, if you add in all the streams of revenue, they've been able to do pretty decently.
Tony?
Yeah, I think that's, well, as someone who works in the newspaper business and spends a lot of time talking to people in the movie business, I've been struck by some interesting parallels, mostly having to do, I think, with what's coming and a sense of anxiety in Hollywood, that the business model that's served them very well, you know, through its ups and downs for, you know, since the movies were invented, which places theatrical distribution right at the center as the kind of flagship, is changing, and I think it's changing especially in some of the more middle-sized and smaller releases. So I've had, you know, people who run, you know, art house or specialty or quasi-independent distributors saying that, you know, when they release a movie in the theaters, it's basically a trailer for the DVDs or for other you know, forms of what they call the ancillary markets. So I think there's a lot of nervousness and wondering of what it's going to be look like, you know, when everyone can get video on demand on their plasma screen TV, you know, in a perfect high definition transfer, or you know, on their iPod or however, you know, whether how much that's going to cut into theatrical ticket sales and how much in terms of the kinds of movies that get made and the way that they enter into the cultural conversation, what effect that's going to have. And I don't think anybody quite knows. So it was a good year for the movies on all fronts. Certainly there were a lot of good movies, which is what I care about the most. But also, you know, they did pretty well, and I think the overall box office was – the trend was up a little bit after being down a little bit last year. But there is a sense that you know, big changes are afoot, and nobody knows quite how it's gonna shake out.
Okay, David, you were gonna say.
Well, I'd say two things. Given the kinds of movies that Tony Scott has talked about, you know, it's hard to say that it's quashed the ability to make the smaller movies, the more artistic films, you know, one will see. I mean, if somebody were the head of Netflix, for example, and they're not able to make the conversion to perhaps a delivery system that incorporates more either broadband or, you know, digital cable, I'd be very nervous in that particular model because I'm not sure everybody's going to be mailing DVDs backward and forward.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, we're interested in hearing your thoughts about the best movies of 2006, and then we're also going to look forward before we end this segment. But let's take a call now from Chad in Lansing, Michigan. Chad, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
It's funny with that intro because I just had a comment about one of the worst movies.
Oh, okay. Good.
It was the that Nicolas Cage, the Twin Towers movie.
Yeah, the world, the one about the World Trade Center.
The Oliver Stone movie.
Yes, I heard a lot of people say that it was too early to be made, and I don't necessarily agree, but it was definitely way too graphic. I don't know why anybody would need to be at ground zero. It definitely it brought you right there. It was very graphic.
Chad, thanks for that call. Tony, how? Yeah,
is he gone?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was just running because that was one of two 9/11 movies that came out this year. The other one was United 93, and I was just wondering if he'd maybe seen that one as well.
Oh well. Next time. But what about your reaction? Did you like either of those?
I had a hard time seeing them. I didn't review Flight 93, and I managed to, you know, psych myself out of going to any of the press screenings. And then it was in theaters for a long time, and I kept saying, "Well, I better go see it," and I kept avoiding it, just partly because I wasn't sure, as the caller said, that I wanted to go back to that day. I was quite moved, on the other hand, by the Oliver Stone movie, somewhat to my surprise. I did think it was very faithful to the emotions and experiences of that day. But I think that a lot of people in both of those cases, a lot of audience members kind of said, well, you know, whether or not they thought these movies should have been made, I think chose not to be reminded of you know, what they were about.
We're talking with Tony Scott, film critic for The New York Times, and David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR. We're taking your calls at 1-800-989-8255 about the year in culture. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tony, I just wonder, was there a standout performance in 2006, do you think, from an actor or an actress?
I think there were quite a few. It was a very good year for actresses. I think there's a common complaint that there are no good roles for women these days, especially not women, you know, over 25 or 30. I think that this was an exception, and I hope maybe, you know, the start of a pattern. Penelope Cruz in Volver, Pedro Almodovar's wonderful Spanish melodrama. Mm-hmm. I had been very skeptical of Penelope Cruz, having watched her not really act very well, mm-hmm, in four different languages and in different movies, and I thought she was amazing in this. I mean, really kind of evoking the great European movie star screen goddess tradition of Sophia Loren and Anna Magnani and Melina Mercouri, and she was wonderful. I also thought just about the whole cast of Little Children, Kate Winslet, Patrick Wilson, Jackie Earle Haley, Jennifer Connelly were all terrific. Maybe single out Kate Winslet in that one. Mm-hmm. Of course, Helen Mirren, who everyone is talking about quite rightly, in The Queen, which is just a tour de force of a certain kind of British acting. Very, you know, very restrained, shows very little, but somehow also a very, very eloquent, very, very moving performance, and just kind of technically breathtaking.
Tony, before I let you go, I need to ask you to look forward for us. What's coming in 2007? Is this going to be another year of the sequel?
Well, yes. I was just, looking at some websites and making a little list, and, you know, we have just in the first 6 months of the year, Ocean's 13, the new Harry Potter movie, the Fantastic Four Part 2, Shrek 3, Spider-Man 3, Evan Almighty, which is a sequel to Bruce Almighty. I think the Die Hard franchise is being revived. So there's no shortage of that kind of branded entertainment. I think we'll have another Pirates of the Caribbean. And this is always, you know, this is always what it looks like going into a year, because mm-hmm, those are the release dates that are locked up.
I see.
I'm always hopeful. I always sort of look at the landscape in January and think, wow, that's what I'm going to have to deal with for this year. But then there are always surprises, and there are a few movies in the first few months of this year that I think slightly smaller scale, some foreign language movies, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, about the Irish Rebellion that won the top prize in Cannes last year, is coming out, I think, in March. A very interesting movie from Germany called The Lives of Others. That's a Oscar Best Foreign Language Film contender. So
Okay.
There's always cause for cynicism and cause for hope.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to stop this conversation. Right. Tony, thanks very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
A.O. Scott is a film critic for The New York Times. He joined us by phone today from his home in New York. We'll be talking more about media with David Folkenflik, who's agreed graciously to stay with me in Studio 3A. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. For the next little bit, we'll be talking with David Folkenflik, who stayed with me here in Studio 3A, and we've been talking about the year in culture, and we're also going to do a little look forward. But we haven't really talked yet, David, about TV, that dinosaur. But I guess it's not a dinosaur. I mean, they're selling these flat panel screens and high-definition cable like they're expecting it to be around for a while.
Yeah, I think TV will be around here for a while. I mean, there's the claims that somehow it's going to go away. It clearly isn't going away. There's the claim that all creativity has died out. I'm not sure you can see that either. We were just talking with A.O. Scott of The New York Times, and he mentioned, I believe, Helen Mirren from the movie The Queen. She also portrayed this other kind of British woman on the final Prime Suspect on PBS as, I think, Chief Inspector Jane Tennyson.
Yeah.
And it was phenomenal about this performance of this kind of broken, brilliant, brash woman cop in a very male hierarchy. And it was, you know, it was interesting to see that. You saw The Wire on HBO, which was this extended series, which has been on several years now. I don't know if you saw cultural praise for a show as strong as that since, like, the movie Casablanca or maybe, you know, The Bible. The New York Times editorialized in its praises, ran an actual editorial talking about The Wire, an astonishing thing. I was also a little thinking about the ways in which we get these shows nowadays. I was talking with a few friends in recent days, remembering a couple years ago, BMW did these online ads, and they were actually little, like, 8 or 9 minute movies that you could watch online. And Clive Owen, who was just in the movie Children of Men, sort of starred in this adventure, almost Bond-like film. Well, now I got to say, there's some shows that I've seen initially or almost exclusively for free online. And you're watching, you know, NBC has two shows now about basically knockoffs of Saturday Night Live. And one is Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which is done by Aaron Sorkin, late of the West Wing.
Yeah.
And the other is 30 Rock, which is done by the former chief comedy writer for Saturday Night Live, Tina Fey. I watched the first episode of that on TV, regular time.
Huh.
I thought it was very weak. I didn't really return to it. Some friends mentioned it to me. And so many weeks later, I caught up and watched online a few of the later shows. They were very, very funny and very interesting, and it brought me in. Studio 60, similarly, on shows I've missed, I've been able to watch it that way. And one of the interesting things coming out of the network is that it seems as though, if you read the trade publications about television, that Studio 60, which is getting a full run of shows despite kind of tepid ratings on television, is getting picked up at least partly because the demographics of its viewers are quite desirable for advertisers when you toss in those who watch it both delayed on digital cable for free, and also for free online at NBC.com. Very interesting development. You would never have heard this happening just a few years ago.
I mean, it's amazing. I guess I'm thinking now, you know, everything, people have really been given the opportunity to time shift. They can have things when it suits them. And I'm sure there are people who will be listening to this program sometime in the next week or two because somebody said you were great on it and they have to go back and listen.
Most of them direct relatives.
Right.
I'm assuming my uncle and aunt will be
doing that
shortly.
It's really an interesting shift in culture, and I guess it's going to continue. But we've reached that time, which I've really been anxious to get to this. So 2007 is about 15 hours old now.
Sure.
And we've been doing a look back on 2006, but I've really been anxious to do a look back on 2007. I think NPR needs to get out in front on this story.
Well, you always like to set the agenda.
I think the news agenda here should be, what do we think the most important stories, certainly in your field, have been for 2007? So this is our look back at 2007. David, where do you think what stands out to you as the most important story so far this year?
Well, I'd put it this way. I think the most important story for the media in 2007 is going to be a bit of a shocker.
Mm-hmm.
As you may know, in the automotive field, there are now programs tested out in Southern California where cars can follow one another in traffic without having to be driven by the drivers because they've got these little special gizmos where you can just follow along in traffic. Mm-hmm. Additionally, as you may know, there's self-parking cars from Lexus. Mm-hmm. And people can now, if they get their car souped up enough, they can now actually just get the World Wide Web in that screen where you used to simply just have a radio. What's not going to be known until it's broken and until actually it proves to be true, which it's absolutely not, is that it turns out all of this will have been funded by the Newspaper Association of America. Desperate to find a place where you're going to sit down and have nothing else to do, they're trying to figure out a way to force-feed you the newspaper of the future. And I think, you know, once this is broken open by Cy Hirsch or Bob Woodward, that'll be a huge story.
Okay, you heard it here, and we're prepared next year at this same time to ask you if you were right or not. David, thanks very much for that.
Good to join you.
David Folkenflik is NPR's media critic. He joined me here in Studio 3A.